Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And no time like the present to bring back our old friend Adam Davies to the program. It's crazy. Before I started the show tonight, I was thinking to myself, Jesus, I feel like I just got off the phone with Micah. These shows are coming fast and furious, but here we are with another edition of the program, and I'm excited about this one because I was thinking about it. You know, we're sort of revisiting a lot of our favorite guests and our old friends from the show who've been on the show over the years and has dug it up here today. First time we ever talked to Adam Davies was November 9th, 2008. So we used to tape the shows a little bit ahead of time back then, so it was probably like September or something like that. But so, essentially since the fall of 2008, almost a decade, we've been talking to Adam Davies about his adventures. And as I was telling him, I had the chance to meet him. We'll talk more about this later at the end of the show. But I finally had the chance to meet Adam and get some drinks and a fine meal while I was out in San Diego in April. And it was like, some of these guests we have on the show, if you just pull out their episodes, they're kind of like their own awesome story, you know, like the Stan Friedman episodes or the ones we did with Greg Bishop. And Adam is one of those guys as well. It's like this program has followed his evolution in this field and as a researcher and as an explorer almost for a decade now. And it seems like, I'm sure Adam can agree, it's gotten crazier in a way. The more and more, it's gotten crazier in the sense that, more and more strange stuff has happened to him over the years. So it's like he was sort of like bright-eyed. He'd already been through a lot of crazy stuff, but it was like, if only he knew back in the fall of 2008 that it was going to get even crazier. But here we are today, almost a decade later, and welcome back to the show, Adam. It's been a joy to have you on the program all these years, and for our final season, it's great to have you on to sort of put a bow on all this with another update on what you've been up to.
Yeah, Tim, and it's a real pleasure to be on the show. And it feels, 10 years of talking to you. I wish the show wasn't ending, but then, you know, a lot of people do, and I'm with them. I'm sorry it's ending, but it's great to be on it tonight.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, I'll be doing something else down the line, I'm sure.
Good.
You know, reinventing the program. So it's not like this isn't the last time we're going to talk or anything like that.
Good.
It's just I'm tired of doing sort of this season 9, season 10, you know. I have like a weird OCD thing where if I did a season 11, I'd feel compelled to go all the way to like season 15 or season 20. And it's like, I don't know if I can commit to another decade of doing the same thing. So it's like,
I get it.
Put a bow on it with season 10 and then see what happens next. But I wanted to start tonight. This is completely unexpected and something we didn't really obviously know we were going to be talking about. But I know you're safely ensconced in San Diego now, but I know you are a Manchester man. You grew up in Manchester, I think, or at least you lived in Manchester for a very, very long time. When I first met you, you were living in Manchester until you came to San Diego. And I'm sure the just horrifying events last night, hit home for you. I hope that, you know, you didn't know anybody who was affected by that. And I'm sure, like, that even though you're in San Diego now, your heart, hurts over what happened last night, the tragic bombing at the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, England, we're talking about, for folks who maybe listen to this like in months or years from now.
Yeah, it was, well, you're right in the sense that, yes, I'm from Manchester. I mean, my ancestry is half Welsh, half English, but I was born in Manchester. I'm from Manchester. And although I've traveled all over the world, as you know, I've lived in Manchester all my life. And yeah, it was very worrying, actually, because I got back and looked at the news, and I saw that there'd been a bombing in Manchester. And I have a daughter who's quite 13, and she still lives in Manchester with her mother. And she was interested in going to this concert. And so my first thought was, you know, we just mentioned it very casually. We hadn't had a long conversation about it, because why would we?
Yeah.
But she'd mentioned in passing that she might go to this thing, and I was like, oh, great, well, you know, and that was it. But then the night, I was very worried in case she had gone. And, of course, there's an eight-hour time difference between San Diego and the UK. So when I tried to phone up, I couldn't get through to anyone, and it was very unpleasant. Anyway, my sister managed to get hold of her, and finally at 6 o'clock this morning, I found out that she hadn't gone. A couple of her friends had gone, but they were okay. They'd actually been at the concert. Because my understanding is right now that the the scumbag who set off the bomb had set it off in the foyer as people were leaving, and I don't think they'd got to that stage yet, so they were lucky.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's horrendous, but the best way to deal with these people is to make sure that they're obliterated. I hope that anybody who associates with this individual is obliterated, because I can tell you that there won't be virgins waiting for him when he's dead.
Yeah.
As he thinks, so he'll have a special place in hell, just like anybody else who's involved.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, they need to find these people that are behind this, and you know.
Mm-hmm. So it's been a long day and a long night, but you know, my I can't tell you how much my sympathies are with my home city, I am assured that the resolve will be to capture those people responsible, and I have no doubt that if he has any associates, they'll get what's coming to them.
Yeah, I think they already got like one guy in custody, but who knows? You know, you never.
Are
really
they good? Yeah, literally, I came back, worked out, and I've come on the show, so I'll probably catch up with it again after tonight. Once I knew my daughter was okay, I sort of relaxed off it a bit, and I'll pick it up later on.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very unpleasant. Yeah.
Well, I don't know what kind of people you're friends with on Facebook, but good luck, because sometimes you get these people, they come across the Facebook wire, you know, and it's like they don't believe anything. They don't believe anything, and they're already saying this. Like,
you know what?
Like, kids died,
there
man.
There was one. I haven't got a lot of time for this.
Yeah.
I haven't got a lot of time for arguing with people on Facebook. It's like the equivalent of the Weekly World News of journalism. You know what I mean? I just can't be bothered with it. But there was one guy last night who irritated me a bit. Every now and again, someone will irritate me. I'm not beyond it, but 99% of the time I am. It's just every now and again. And it was because I was worrying about my daughter, and this guy had put up a thing going, there's a false flag and all this lot. And I knew from people in Manchester who'd been around the area, who'd heard it, there was no false flag. I was like, oh, you bellend, you know, just freaking analyze it.
Yeah.
People can be too paranoid sometimes, and that's, you know, when you're in this field, it's kind of a tangential point but that sort of thing just turns a lot of people off and say, oh, you know, look at the crazies over there, because you get idiots like that who'll say, oh, it's a false flag. Well, you know, there are explosions all over the place, you know, and there are lots of people in hospital. It's very easy to look that up, and if you're making those sort of assertions, you better have very good evidence, because otherwise you just look paranoid and weird.
Exactly. It's funny how, like, the people that believe the craziest things sometimes can't believe the most real things. It's like...
Absolutely, yeah.
Disconnect. It's so weird.
It is very strange, and I can't really fathom it, so I kind of think, well, use science as your bottom line with a lot of this stuff. But you'll find me throughout this interview saying I don't have all the answers, which is, you know, one of the things I want to get across, in a contrast to people who often say they've got answers for everything.
Well, you know, it's funny. We were kind of talking about that with Mike Hanks last week. It's like, that's why I like the guests that I have had on the show, you know, over the years. Because my guests are, the guests that I have, they're not afraid to be like, I don't know what this means, or I don't know the answer to this, you know. It's like, that's... I'd rather talk to somebody like that than somebody who like steadfastly insists they know all the answers. So.
Yeah, because nobody knows all the answers because we're learning all the time, and it's bullshit to say that they have the truth, the hidden knowledge, the special gift that, that other people don't have.
Right.
I'm just not interested in those sort of assertions at all. Yeah.
Now, since we last had you on the show was the, I like to say, the now infamous, and mm-hmm. we'll kind of get into, like, what the fuck we should be calling this thing, but I stuck to calling it the Bigfoot Portal, almost to thumb my nose at the people who had a fit about it when we first did the show. Easily one of the most controversial and infamous and, as I said on the description here, riveting conversations we've ever had with you and John Carlson about your, for lack of a better term, Bigfoot Portal experience. And looking back, that was October 2015 when we did the show. I think you said it was like in the previous spring, maybe? Was that when you had had the... Yeah, so October.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was in June the year before, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, like... Yeah, so it's been, like, what, a couple of years since you had this experience or thereabouts. And and it was just funny because I remember when we put the episode out, it was just crazy. I'd heard, like, the Bigfoot community was crazy, but this was, like... The reaction was so vehement and insane and was like, I mean, I know you pretty well, dude. I don't think you made up the fucking story. And it was just so captivating to see these people who, like, lost their fucking shit over this story. They, like, there was a person who I had on the show a couple times who we talked about this off the air, who just completely, like, went off the rails and misinterpreted everything, probably due to me calling it the Bigfoot Portal. When it wasn't a Bigfoot portal, it was just some portal.
No, it's nothing to do with Bigfoot. No, nothing to do
with it. Exactly. In a way, it was kind of, and I keep using the thing in a way to kind of test. It's kind of like a test in a way on my end to like test to see if people know what the fuck they're talking about in a sense. Do you know what I mean? Because if someone comes back and they're like, oh, you had him on talking about a Bigfoot portal again, then it's like, okay, so you didn't listen to the show. You know, because there's no Bigfoot involved here in the Bigfoot portal.
There's no Bigfoot in this story whatsoever.
Right.
No.
I just sort of used the term because that was what happened. This person started writing wrote a blog post that was like, fucking people talking about Bigfoot portals. They don't know what they're talking about.
Well, that person, I, you know, she hadn't even read. She hadn't even listened to the show.
That's what I mean, yeah.
She hadn't even listened to what you said. But you know... I think that's a classic example of somebody who's qualifying themselves as bad research. So they haven't even listened to it, and already they've formed an opinion. And it's very important that you can have ideas before you go into it to listen to something, but you need to understand what people are saying first before you shoot off, I think.
Right, exactly. And even better, I think the post had gone up, I think, before we even posted the show. So it's
absolutely.
If you're going to be that close-minded, and for the people who follow along on this program, this is the same person who said fake news began with APRO newsletters. So we're dealing with a real critical thinker here.
Well, yeah.
So
it's kind of a shame.
It is.
Shame for that person. Yeah, it's a shame for that person.
So, I mean, we did a whole show on that. So it's like, I don't want to revisit the whole thing. I mean, the gist of, for people who haven't tuned into that episode, I highly recommend you just stop right now and go listen to it because we're not going to be able to do the experience justice on this revisiting.
No.
But I think just the thumbnail version.
Do you want me to give a thumbnail version?
Yeah, give a thumbnail. Give us like, you know.
I'll give a thumbnail version and then I can move on to what I did after that. So essentially... I was doing some research. I was interested in doing research in three different places with completely different methodology and different characters. And I was interested in that because, you know, I hadn't done a lot of research into the Bigfoot phenomenon at the time, but I was interested in doing some, and I'd originally had some interest in it when I'd done some research in the Cascades in 2012. And because of what had happened there, I was thinking, well, there might be some substance to this whole Bigfoot thing, because I certainly have some interesting results in the Cascades. So I had I went to three different places. I went to the Olympic Project in Washington, and I had some good adventures there. And, you know, people got recordings. I think Shane Corson got a recording at the time which sounded like a Sasquatch, difficult to prove, but certainly sounded like one. And it was great. I had a good time. Then I was whooping at this thing, and it was whooping back. All great fun. Then I was planning on going to Matthew Johnson's, and after that to Justin Smeher and Bart Catino. Justin Smeher claimed to have shot a Bigfoot, and there were different people, different methodologies, and I was interested in just investigating those. And I took my buddy Joel Carlson, who had he was essentially my friend, more interested in esoteric stuff generally, but not particularly in the whole Bigfoot thing. It was just something, he just coming along to see me, and we were hanging out. First of all, we went to the Olympic Projects, as I said, and then we went over to see Matthew Johnson at his site. He claimed to be a habituator and had a special relationship with Bigfoot. To cut a long story short, what was very, very difficult about the whole thing was, three nights in, John and I were just smoking these. We were smoking cigars. John had bought these cigars over from New Jersey. We were smoking those at the back of this this spherical area, for want of a better word, which is the area where Matthew Johnson likes people to operate inside when he's doing the. He says he's getting the Bigfoot. And he was playing this music, and it was pretty cheesy, and we were joking around, me and John, and then it was getting very, very late because we were up pretty late talking away, and I saw what looked like a straight white line, a straight light across the road, and it didn't seem like natural daylight. So I said to John, "What's that?" And he said, "I have no idea." And then the thing started crackling. There was a crackling, and there was a mist, and there was, I don't know, different color crackling. And then these two things popped out of this crackling mist, and I was like, "Oh shit, what are they?"
Yeah.
And they hung around. They didn't do very much for a while. And then they were small and they were dark, and they had bright, red pointed eyes. And they just hung around at first, and we were watching them, and they were watching us. We showed Johnson them very briefly, and that was it, really. That was the extent of his involvement.
What did he say? I'm trying to remember. What did he say when?
Well, he said at the time, he said he didn't know what they were. He'd never seen anything like that before. And then he went off to bed, and which was strange. And then we stayed up looking at these things, and I said, "Well, you know, I'm not going to sleep with those friggin' things hanging around. I've never seen anything like them." And John said, "Yeah," shouted down the pathway, because they were, I think they were, I can't remember exactly now, but they were about 150 yards away from what I can remember, down the pathway, but they weren't moving. They were just like, well, just like waiting. And they were in this strange sort of orangey, raggedy glow. They're the weirdest shit I've ever seen. I've seen some strange stuff, but I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
But at that point, although I was disturbed, I wasn't worried, per se. I was just like a bit freaked out, because I'd seen them, but I wasn't worried because they were down the path. They weren't threatening. But when John shouted, "What are you going to do if we don't go to bed?" the two freaking things came rushing at us. And that was a terrible, it sounds ridiculous, but it was one of the worst moments of my life, because these things come charging towards us. And I could look at this damn thing's face, and I could see the hate on its face, like proper hate.
Yeah.
Like when someone's in a rage, it was like that. And I thought, well, how the fuck am I going to fight this thing? What am I going to do here? I'm going to get ready to kick it in the head or whatever else. And I shone a light to get a better look at the thing. But my last thought before I did that really was, well, shit, this is going to be how it's going to end. I'm going to die in these friggin' woods. No one's going to ever guess how it happened.
Right.
And John are going to be dead. Yeah, and that's it, you know, nothing, and that, no one's going to know, yeah? And when I shone the light, the bloody things disappeared, yeah?
Wow.
And then nothing happened, it looked like they just were not there. And then a few minutes later, this thing started crackling again, and the two little bastards popped up again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned it to Johnson, and Johnson went running down the path with his 45, going, "You're not welcome here." And then he went back, and then he went back to bed. And, you know, this carried on basically for two nights. In the day there was nothing, and John and I were there. And every time, for some reason, we shone a light, the thing disappeared. But it was like there was a lot of energy. It was like a crackling before they pop out. And then they pop out. And it took about 4 minutes on average for them to pop out. But one time it was really quick, like they were rushing to do it. And it carried on for 2 nights, and it was the strangest, weirdest thing that has ever happened to me.
How did it down on these nights? Did they just eventually, the light went away?
The moment it got to daylight, which was, you know, five-ish, it was like, it felt different. And it seems strange because it felt very malevolent. So when it was happening, it felt very malevolent, and they felt very malevolent. But when it got to daylight, it was like nothing had ever happened.
Yeah.
Boom. You know, it was totally strange, and it happened the first night, and I was so confounded by it. It was three nights in that this happened, and we were staying for four. The third night it happened, I was so confounded by it. I thought, I've got to stay for the other night and see if it actually happens, because I was struggling to believe it myself. And it happened again on the second night.
Yeah.
And so, but basically, what happened next was we were struggling to really understand that. And, you know, Johnson at first, I think he was quite perturbed about it. But then he says, oh, well, you know, I've had a message from my Bigfoot guardian or something, Zorf or whatever he was called, I can't remember. And he said, they're guardians of the portal or some shit like that. And I was like, well, they're not guardians of anything. I said, they freaking well attacked me and John.
Yeah, you got
to give me this. They were not guardians of anything. I said, you're just saying that because it fits the narrative that you want. This is a lovely old place, you know.
Right.
Anyway, so we had that discussion. I said, look, I don't want to talk about it. And there were several good reasons that we didn't want to talk about it. The first thing was that John and I were quite disturbed by it. And I think Johnson was at the time. He told his admins he was in his group. Since then, he's said something different. But we were disturbed by it, and really disturbed by it. And John and I, ever since then, have spent a lot of time talking about it privately. And, you know, because it was very difficult to process. And I also, at the time, and I never realized it then, was working for the British government. And some of the information I saw, I'm not trying to make out of James Bond, but some of it was required security clearance, you know?
Right, right, yeah.
And it was not a good career move to be saying, I've seen these damn things, you know, in public. It would not have gone down very well, I think.
Right.
And thirdly, I wanted to understand this because I recognised that to most people it would seem a very bizarre and unusual story. And frankly, I didn't need the shit, Tim, you know. I didn't need a load of people going, oh, I don't believe it, I don't care.
Right,
what benefit is for me to tell this story and just get a load of shit and be called, you know, just crazy? There was no benefit. I didn't need the attention. There was no merit in me hearing it. But there were two very good reasons, and one, and they were in that order, really. In his book, Johnson says that the reason he went public with it because he was doing me and John a favour, being desensitizing it to it. But that's bull. I mean, at the end of the day, he knew very well that I had that for him to reveal that would have risked my job. I told him that, and he still went ahead. And in his book, he doesn't mention that point, of course.
Yeah. But, so he put out a book that covered this.
Yeah, he's put out a book, and in that he says that, you know, the reason he went public with it was because it was a good idea for me and John because we were suffering from PTSD, and what we needed was to be opened up, and he was helping us.
Oh, what an
ass. You know what? That isn't true. I mean, I made it very clear to him that I would talk about it one day, but I wanted to do lots of research and understand it. And at the time, it could really have jeopardized my job.
Yeah.
And he still went, did he? He stuck on a bandana on his head and went for his Team Squatching USA Facebook group meeting or whatever it is, talked about it in public. We didn't know he was going to talk about it. He never said anything to John and I. And the next day, I'm bombarded with loads of things on Facebook going, what's this creature? What are these guardians of the poor? What are you talking about? Guardians of anything? Did you know it's completely not the truth.
Yeah.
It wasn't his story to tell. He made played a very small part in the whole thing. And, you know, what irritates me about all of this is that for me and John, that is a very unpleasant, deeply unpleasant, traumatic experience, which he knows. It's very difficult for other people to get it. It's really difficult. Even when you're explaining it to partners or really close friends, the first time I actually told the account of what happened to me, I didn't tell it, other than to Nadia, I didn't tell it for a long time to even family and friends. And when I first told my friends who I'd been back home in the pub in Manchester, I'd been friendly with for years, I told them it. There was just dead silence at the pub. You know, I just tell them, I said, this is what I've got to tell you. I haven't told anybody. And they were just silent. And my family couldn't process it. My sister got very upset and cried. You know, it was a very unpleasant experience for us. And it was very important that I tried to understand it. It's not friggin' Bigfoot. Do you know what I mean? The idea that something's got, that's got the technology to actually do these things. There's a few points I'll make. The idea that something's got the technology, that's got the ability to create this sort of technology, would go into the woods and steal Matthew Johnson's mouldy donuts and or whatever, take them. It's just beyond contemplation. It's just a ridiculous notion, yeah?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's a hell of a long way to go for somebody's second-hand donuts across dimensions or worlds or whatever it is. Yeah, it's just. But these things were real, and it changed my understanding of what the world might be. They're not Bigfoot in any way. Bigfoot, I think, is a real. Let me just say this: it's a real flesh and blood creature. I think it's very rare. I'm interested in gathering scientific evidence for its existence. This was something completely different, yeah? Some sort of paranormal thing, I don't know what. Now, some people suggest that Johnson has maybe hoaxed me and John in some way, yeah? I don't think he hoaxed me. I don't think he's got the capability to do that, the technology to do that. And also, you know, it wouldn't have fitted with his narrative. Johnson didn't want me to go away and John to go away. What Johnson wanted me to do was to go away saying, you know what? That Matthew Johnson, he's got all the answers. He's got the key to Bigfoot, you know, because that would have suited him. He didn't want me to have this horrific encounter. I don't think he made it up at all. I think he's tried to own it as his own thing. Now, it has happened, but it wasn't his inception. It wasn't his idea. It wasn't his. He didn't manipulate me in that way to create these things. These things were bloody real. They're very strange, but they're nothing to do with Bigfoot. They're some sort of paranormal phenomenon. Now, you can just use paranormal and be a lazy term in the sense that, oh, if it's paranormal, we can just get away with anything. I'm not interested in doing that. I'm interested in finding answers to it, measuring it and understanding it. And some of what I've done over the last couple of years has been an attempt to understand that.
Yeah. All right. That was the thumbnail on that. That covers that pretty much. Yeah, I mean... So you've ruled out, you ruled out in your mind a hoax, because to pull off something like that, this guy would have to have, like, I don't even know, a hologram machine or something.
Yeah, and it, you know what, if he wanted to, let's just say he had a hologram machine, and I was all over the place looking around, let's just say the guy had a hologram machine. What's he going to create on a hologram machine? He's going to create some nice Bigfoot things, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Wandering around, yeah. Being nice, him interacting with them, and... looking like magic or whatever, because that's what he wants. He wants to be seen as some sort of special, gifted teacher who's got the answers to Bigfoot. Yeah, that's what he wants, yeah? He puts himself, oh, I don't really want this position. Yes, he damn well does. He wants to be known like that. So the idea of having these things which look nothing like a Bigfoot in anybody's account, and then them attacking us, and they did bloody well attack us. They got very close to us. And it's only by fortune that they didn't finish us off, I think, or do something unpleasant to us. It didn't fit his narrative.
Right.
It's not what he wanted to sell to me. He was desperate for me to come away saying he's the greatest Bigfoot researcher in the USA. That's what he wanted me to say. He wanted me to say, oh, he's better than Derek Randall, Bart Catino, anybody else, you know. any of these people who are Bigfooters, he's the man with the answers. That's what he wanted. He didn't want me to come away with my friend deeply traumatized. You know?
Yeah. So having had a couple of years to process this, I mean, you don't have any answers, but have you sort of come to any, have you sort of like followed any sort of path as far as what you think you experienced in the woods that night or those nights?
Well, the first thing to do is to look at what science was actually recovered, yeah, which has been lost in all of this and glossed over by Johnson. So the only science that I'm aware, I mean, what I was after doing was gathering hair samples. So Johnson lays out these bowls, which he calls gifting bowls, and he says that Bigfoot comes and takes the food from the bowls, yeah? I recovered some hair from those bowls. I got Todd Bissatel from the University of New York to test that hair. And that hair came back as canid, so dog. Most probably, and this is an assumption on my part, from his small dog was there.
Yeah.
But it wasn't anything that could have been in any way related to a Bigfoot, yeah?
Yeah.
So, what I felt I needed to do was explore this whole phenomenon, because it didn't make sense, because I'd seen something which didn't make sense. There was definitely things happening there, very strange things at this location, which I couldn't explain. I think it was important to investigate it. And also to consider other avenues of investigation, which I wouldn't normally have considered, in an attempt to understand it. So one of the things I did was I thought, I've never been shown an interest in ghosts or aliens or anything else like that. So I went to both Roswell and Area 51, or to the edge of it, and had a look at the alien phenomenon and did some research on that. And we'll come on to it later. And I happened to live near the Whaley House, which is the most haunted house, allegedly, in America. So I got myself a job as a tour guide there. I passed the test, and I work as a tour guide there part of the time, and investigated that phenomenon.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, you know what? I'm prepared to consider all possibilities, things I've never had other than a campfire interest in before. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'll go down the path and investigate them. By the same token, I went back to Sewer, without Johnson, obviously, on two further occasions, and I conducted some experiments to see what would happen. And some of them, I think, you know, you can... One of the things... So I took a group. So I took Ed and Kirk Brown, no relation, Russell Accord, Dan Linden... and the first account, first thing, and then later on, Ed's girlfriend Claudia on the second account, second trip, and I went on a couple of these investigations.
Yeah.
The reason I liked taking that group was that I specifically wanted people who weren't just what Johnson does is handpick his people. With that group, I was interested in having people who may or may not necessarily agree and have my views. So Russell, for example. He's very sceptical about all these sort of things, and he's one of these you have to see it to believe it type of guys. He's a good friend of mine now, but then, you know, although we'd met and we'd become friends, we haven't been friends very long.
Yeah.
I wanted people who had different points of view there. And also, we took a load of kit, and there were experiments I wanted to try. So one of the assertions that Johnson makes, for example, is that no animal can, if an animal's going to take food from his gifting bowls, as he puts them, when he puts out donuts or things like that, then it's going to leave crumbs, or the bowl's going to be overturned.
Yeah.
Well, I disproved that, because I set up trail cameras in the areas where he left bowls, and when it's not something I'd do normally, but for the purposes of this experiment, it's quite clearly you can see a deer approach them. I've got a number of shots of the deer approaching, takes the food, the bowl is upturned, it's not upturned, it's left exactly as it was, and there's no crumbs in it, yeah? And the reason I mention this generally is people who habituate will say, well, you know what, the food was taken from my bowl, so it must be a Bigfoot.
Right.
Okay? And the point I'd make to them is, unless you physically saw a Bigfoot take the food from your bowl, you can't make that assumption.
Exactly,
what you have to start with is what's the most likely thing to have taken the food from the bowl, yeah? Look at all the other indigenous species which are around there, raccoon, deer, whatever else. And then if you've had the opportunity to dismiss them from observation or from other evidence, physical or otherwise, then start speculating it might be a Bigfoot, yeah?
How about do the work that Adam Davies fucking did and actually get a game camera and take a picture of whatever's taking the thing from your bowl. So if you want to be the greatest Bigfoot researcher of all time, that's a hell of a way to do it.
It wasn't difficult. And, of course, people would say, well, they don't like trail cameras or whatever else. That's a whole other argument. But the bottom line is, unless you physically see it, you can't make that assumption.
Exactly.
And too many of them will jump to the conclusion, because something took food, it must probably be my Bigfoot. It's my friend Bobby, you know, the Bobby the Bigfoot. So that was one thing I wanted to do, and we disproved that. The other thing that was interesting was to explore this strange phenomenon. You know, and I was hoping, I was almost not hoping, but I was hoping, for a return of these creatures, because I thought that would have been quite interesting. But they didn't show up, but there was strange phenomenon that people reported, particularly we were using infrared binoculars. And at one stage, the night vision binoculars, sorry, and at one stage, we saw, three of us saw, an orange glow in the night vision binoculars, which is impossible, because you can only see green and black and white, as you know. You
right.
can't see a colour, but we were all seeing an orange glow, which is inexplicable. And by the same token, Russ on the other side saw this white pulsating object, again through his night vision binoculars, on a different occasion. So strange, and that's just a synopsis of things. So you can, you know, what I found myself doing was disproving the physical evidence, which was related per se to an alleged Bigfoot, but reinforcing the more paranormal aspects
yeah.
of the thing. Yeah. So.
But no Portal experience those visits.
So what I, you know, my view, very simply, on this whole area is that, you know, this is very much an area where there's some sort of paranormal thing which is outside as yet our understanding, but it won't stop me you know, attempting to measure and analyze it, because that's what it's about, you know.
Right.
That's what good science is about. So I will continue to do that with the best tools I have available, and I'm very interested in how that might work out. Not just there, but, you know, he's gone on to make a number of claims in his what's it called, the Big Reveal, where he says, you know, that there are alien shapeshifters, and that there's stuff from his friends built a machine that can bring all these aliens over, and he saved them, and I don't know, there's this thing that he can travel through time, and all of these things are contradictory. So, you know, if they can travel through time, why haven't they, you know, why, you know, they've been around since the dinosaurs. Well, why? Well, we were like shrews when the dinosaurs were around, you know,
right,
our ancestors.
Right.
So why would they be waiting millions of years to do that? Why would they, if they had any technology, any of these things, be going after moldy donuts and breaded goods? They could get whatever they bloody well wanted, you know.
Right, right.
And it kind of irritates me, and it irritates, I think, John, in the sense that this confabulation of contradictory ideas, because I think you said at one stage they're sons of Cain and now they're aliens or something. they sort of denigrate for me and for John, which was a very harrowing and personal account of something that I'm trying to make sense of, and will probably continue to try and make sense of for the rest of my life, with this ridiculous stories that have been concocted around it, you know. And for me, it's a very unpleasant thing. I never wanted to talk about, or would have talked about eventually, but only after a long time. And, you know, I and because of that, it's been clouded in this other stuff, which I want to make very clear I completely distance myself from.
Exactly.
What happened to me and John? I mean, John, you know, people say, well, what do you think they were? Now, John's very clear that these things, in his mind, were demonic. Now, I say, and again, I don't know what they were, yeah?
Right.
They were certainly malevolent because they were trying to attack me. But I have no idea what they were or where they were from. And that's my position on them. I don't have an answer to what they are. But I'm all right, you know. I don't mind somebody having a different opinion to me necessarily, as I say with John, because you
well,
know
he was
what?
There. I mean, yeah.
He was there. He experienced it. We've discussed it. And you know, he's treating me very respectfully.
Right.
I'm fine with that. But in contrast to the other individual who's done completely the opposite and come out with this rubbish.
Yeah. Now, somebody in the chat room wants to know, and I was kind of wondering this too. He says he wants to know what happened to you after you came out with this experience, which I think, like, you first talked about it on our show about a year and a half ago. Because he was concerned you were doing research suicide by speaking out about this. So it sounds like you've just carried on. It's just more like an annoyance that this thing's kind of like.
Yeah,
over
I didn't talk about it for a long time, and then I did eventually because Johnson was going on and on and on about it, and I did talk about it, and then I've carried on doing other things, and so you know I want to say right now that my cryptozoological research and the things that I've done, you know, are completely different. I think that Bigfoot, Sasquatch, whatever else, is a real flesh and blood creature. But it's got nothing to do with, you know, a creature right now that is probably more intelligent than a great ape, but less intelligent than us, for want of a better word, with very limited tool use, very rare, very elusive, quite sharp. But you know, the idea that it's got all these abilities like traveling through portals and psychic and all that, I find very difficult to believe. Yeah?
Yeah.
It's inconsistent with its behavior, its approach, its technology, its methodology. And I have tracked, and like 99.999% of these alleged Bigfoot researchers and all these other great apes in the wild. I've seen orangutans, gorillas, all of those things, chimps, all of those things. I've seen in the wild and tracked them, you know? So I know what I'm bloody well talking about.
Right, right.
I'm not just knocked a stick on a tree.
Right.
So, you know, I know what I'm talking about, and it's very, very different.
Well, you got an interesting sort of baptism by fire, in a sense, to the American Bigfoot community. Did it sour you sort of on this field, or did it make you realize, oh, this is why they can't find fucking Bigfoot, because the field is populated by a lot of, like, people making outrageous claims and then arguing with each other about things and, like, I mean, there's a lot of great people in the Bigfoot research field, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the point, there's also a lot of, like, individuals who, you know, just are chaos agents. So, I guess what...
Well, I get your point. Yeah, I mean, I think there are a number of really decent people who've been very nice to me. What I don't want to do is waste time arguing with people on Facebook.
Right.
You know, as I said to you before, Weekly World News. That's not what I'm interested in. Yeah, I mean, I've taken some flack, but then, you know, I move on from that. I'm not really interested in dealing with a lot of that. What I'm interested in is finding scientific evidence of things that I can quantify and prove. And I'm also interested in the mysteries of things. So, you know, I think what I'd say is this. I don't have a problem with anybody saying that, you know, even the wilder things. From my own point of view, you're asking me what I think. If somebody says, you know what, I've got a Bigfoot in my back garden, you know, I'm okay with them saying that. But you know, if you're into asking me to be involved, then I want to see some evidence of it, yeah?
Right.
And if you're making money by publishing the book My Bigfoot in My Back Garden, you know.
I like your southern accent.
Then,
this is great.
Yeah.
You got an English guy doing a southern accent.
Yeah. Well, if you're publishing a book saying that, yeah, then you should be open to objective scrutiny. And the only way you're ever going to get evidence of stuff like this is by using scientific methodology. If you turn around to me and say, you know what, I'm not interested in any of that. I just want to have my relationship with my Bigfoot. I've called him Bobby. He sits in my back garden. You send me a picture of a bush, yeah, and say, this is Bobby, then good luck to you, yeah? Good luck to you, eccentric weirdo. But when you say to me, you know, I'm going to publish my book, Bobby the Bigfoot in my back garden, and you're taking other people's money, then I'm going to come at you and ask you lots of questions because you're taking money.
Exactly.
Or if even worse, if you say that Bobby the Bigfoot in my back garden has magical healing powers, then I'm probably going to be pretty shitty with you because I've had a sister that died of cancer, and I'm not having you fucking around that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you know, but I'm very open about my own prejudice, and I think you know when you're doing research and science, you need to be aware of your own prejudices. So I'll be much more hostile to somebody who says he's got a Bigfoot with magical healing powers because of what's happened to me personally.
Right.
I'm going to be, I get sent pictures of bushes every week with someone saying, oh, there's a Bigfoot in this bush. And I don't care about that. That's harmless. But I just think it's odd. But I do care about it when people are publishing books because then they're taking other people's money. So that's my position on it. But at the end of the day, what you have to focus on, for me personally, I'm interested in scientific evidence, yeah?
Right.
So, you know, with Bigfoot or Yetis or anything else, I'm going to sort of think, what are the best tools I've got available that I can use to try and get evidence? And what experiments are is they should be objective, measurable, and repeatable.
Mm.
So that's the process that I'm trying to follow in all of my research. And, you know, and also to try and get answers to some of the mysteries that come along. Yeah.
Now, in retrospect, having looked at this stuff or having experienced this, have you, and old school Nate asks in the chat room, and I'm going to sort of piggyback onto his question. He asks if you're aware of the old tradition of mysterious mists / fog being associated with openings to other worlds. And I guess my question is to sort of piggyback onto that is, like, have you sought out sort of any, you know, template or reference points or any sort of connections between your experience and something that other people have reported, whether it's old traditions like Nate's talking about in the chat room or just modern paranormal experiences by people who, you know, who have reported them, you know, in relatively recent years?
Well, if we're talking about those things, those creatures that I saw, then yes, on one occasion. Somebody came to me, I'm not going to say who it is, somebody came to me and recounted a very similar experience to me that he'd had in Washington, which had caused him not to go into, he was interested in going in the woods, and he hadn't gone into the woods for some 5 years. But, you know, the thing again, something very similar happened to him, has happened to me and John. But I said to him, you know, I've been all over the world since. I've been out on my own at night and in the US, and nothing like that's ever happened anywhere else to me, yeah?
Yeah.
Or even come close. In all my years of research, nothing like that has ever happened to me anywhere else, ever.
Hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
So hopefully I was able to help him a little bit. I mean, I spoke to him for a while. This is a long conversation I had with him. But hopefully I was able to help reassure him a little bit that it's most likely to be an aberration. And if something like that has happened to you, it's very unlikely to happen to you again or anywhere else. But there was only one other person I spoke to who'd had something similar. I've not been able to... when I spoke to Lauren Coleman, he talked about the fact that they might be pudgies or something, some other little creature, which was malevolent in the forest. But I think there were differences between what I saw and these pudgy-type creatures that he was talking about. I think it was probably a very, very unusual experience. I don't know whether I'll ever get answers to it, Tim.
Yeah,
but,
I doubt you will.
You know, I
hate to sound negative, but I doubt
you
will.
Yeah, I don't think I ever will, but I mean, I do think about it every day, of course, quite a lot. You know, since then I've talked to John about it quite a lot. And I don't think I will, you know, but and I can't say it enough, but it's completely different from Bigfoot. It's like the difference between, you know, a parrot and an albatross.
That's why I call it the Bigfoot portal, in a sense, to weed out the assholes who don't know who don't.
It's completely different. It's got nothing to do with Bigfoot in any way.
Now watch. We'll see on Twitter. Someone will be like, "Oh, he's fucking doing the Bigfoot portal." Thanks for letting me know.
Exactly. And it's totally, totally, totally different. You know, and my cryptozoological research is completely separate. And I don't. I'm yet to see a demonstrable overlap between that and any paranormal stuff.
Yeah. Now, do you, having had 2 years to look back on this, is there anything you wish you had done differently in the moment when the experience was happening? Is there anything you're like, I should have done this instead of that? I mean, because I second-guess like a lot of shit in my life, so I'm wondering.
I think at the time when I thought I hadn't taken any photographs. But when I went back over my camera, I did take photographs, but nothing came out on them. So I did have the presence of mind to take a shoot off a couple of photographs, but nothing appeared as far as I could see, which was perplexing. You know, again, I don't think at the time there's anything I could have done differently, because there's nothing that I could have done that would have prepared me for that, you know.
Right.
There's no way I could have reasonably foreseen him, even in my wildest dreams, that something that would ever have happened. You know, never, ever, ever in a million years could I ever have foreseen anything like that. I don't think so. I mean, when I went back again, I was able to repeat experiments, which I found interesting, like I told you about the ones with the bowls. And I was actually reassured in a way that I took other people there who had no connection, say, with John Carson, and I hadn't known that long, and they were able to have weird experiences too, you know? All the people that I went with, in different ways, all had weird, inexplicable experiences.
Yeah.
So that points to me, like, you know, John, I never thought that Johnson tried to
pull a fast one.
Hoax us. Yeah, I don't think he ever did. I think he has, you know, as I say, I don't agree with his aversion accounts, and I think some of his notions are delusional. In fact, most of them. But I don't think he tried to hoax us. It wouldn't have fitted his narrative.
Right, right.
But it's worth, you know, it's led me to go down other paths, to explore other things. As I say, that I would never have previously considered, and that's a good thing, I think, in some ways. If I'm looking for a positive out of it, I suppose it's the thought that I've actually gone on and looked for other things, which has been interesting.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, it's not... And providing I'm keeping grounded in the sense that I'm using scientific methodology, it's a good thing. You know, it's not... People say, oh, you know, I heard that. Is it a bad idea? Is it suicide to do this? No, it's not. It's useful to explore other avenues, providing you're, when you do them, you're using the right protocols. And, you know, I'm very careful to say I'm not special, chosen, gifted, or anything else.
Right.
In those respects. And if I'm trying to measure and understand things, I'm using methodology. And if it's limited by the technology we know right now, then I'll try other things, yeah?
Having met Adam in person, folks, I can attest he is not special. he's a wonderful guy, and I this thing is like a blessing and a curse for you. It's like I feel bad that you've had to deal with all this for so long. It's funny. I wonder if like part of the backlash, in a sense, from some of these people is like because you wouldn't confirm their pre-existing belief because it wasn't a fucking Bigfoot portal, like you know.
Well, you know, I get. Hassle, I'm sure. I get hassle all the time from all sorts of different types of people. And I pretty much ignore it. I'm not really interested.
Yeah.
I'm not standing for the Bigfoot party. I'm not trying to be elected. I'm not. It's not a popularity contest. I don't really give a shit what most people think. You know?
Right.
All I care about is if I can actually find it, further my understanding and prove if things exist. And so mainly, the whole reason I started off doing these things and was because of the adventure and my own intellectual curiosity. And that's what has taken me all over the world doing these things for so many years. And I don't really care if some dickhead's slagging me off on Facebook or something else or whatever, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So what?
But you know what I'm saying. I wonder sometimes if the backlash is that.
Yeah, I can give a shit for the backlash. They can do their worst.
Confirming their own ideas that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you do get this cognitive dissonance point, you know, and I completely understand it when people's beliefs are challenged by things and they don't like to hear it. You know, so people have very set views of what these things might be. And if someone comes along and challenges that, people don't like that.
Right, right.
But I don't really care. And I don't mean that disrespectfully. I just don't.
Yeah, man. You know, it's a mess. Now, tell me about. We're going to pivot off of the Bigfoot portal for a little while. Now, there's the guy in the chat room. He's the guy that told you about his experience. So he wants to call in, but I don't know if we're going to be able to do that tonight because this is a special episode. You know, we're kind of wrapping up the seasonal format
here.
Yeah, I've
got quite a lot
to do. We don't want to devote a whole show to someone. You know, give someone else like a half hour to tell their story. Maybe at the end of the show after we wrap it up with Adam. Maybe. Otherwise, I'll circle back on this guy and try and get the info.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure people would like to hear that story.
But
you were on a show.
So this is the guy who spoke to me, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, yeah. Anyway, go on.
All right, so you were on the Josh Gates show?
Yeah, one of the producers, one of the producers contacted me and said, you know, you've been to Nepal before and looked for the Yeti. And I had. I'd done a Monster Quest show entitled The Abominable Snowman, and I'd led an expedition to Nepal, and it was a pretty unpleasant, it was pretty dangerous on the mountaintops that we went on. I nearly slipped off that mountain and died. And we nearly got caught in an avalanche. There are all sorts of adventures that I could tell you about that. But they said, you know, we'd like to do a show. Where would you like to go? And when I'd done the show in Nepal, I was a bit disturbed because I was worried about the fact that most of the eyewitness testimonies that I'd heard about were becoming increasingly from older people, and they were becoming few and far between.
Yeah, there was an article in the Times about that. The Yeti was, the Yeti was dying out because the people weren't.
Yeah, some people, including Jeff Meldrum, had said that, you know, and I'd been to the west of Nepal, so they said to me, well, you know, where do you want to go? And there were a couple of isolated pockets we could have gone to. But I thought, well, you know, I'll try the east. We'll go towards the east. We'll go to the area where there's been a higher population density and take a risk, yeah? So I sent out a researcher there in advance of us to go to the east side of the show, for the show, and go there. And, you know, it turned out very well. Again, in a nutshell, I was in an area near a village called Monjo, and there had been a lot of, and this was an area where on Destination Truth, there was a guy called Tula. Josh Gates had a show previously in this area for Destination Truth, and there was a guy there, a Sherpa, on Destination Truth, and he had found a print. So he'd been on the riverbank there.
Yeah.
And he'd been doing some tracking. And Thule had found the print. Josh Gates is not a tracker. I mean, even he would say he wouldn't be someone who'd find one. Unlikely to find a print, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy Thule had found this print. Anyway, I said, well, let's go to this area again. Now, when they're making this film, they have this big entourage. They had government ministers and people carrying things and everything else. And I said to the producer, I said, for the purposes of this exercise, I want everybody to stay back. I want just myself, Josh Gates, and Thule, the guy who was the other tracker. And what I want to do is go to an area not exactly in the same place because there had been an earthquake previously, which had caused a rock slide in this area, but to go to a place, you know, farther down the river. Because what I was speculating was that in the dry season, the Yeti was coming to this particular area to drink from the river, you know, just in the same way as other animals does. It's not rocket science, but something, you know, it's pretty obvious from tracking animals. So I had all these people stay away, and I had all this entourage stay back, and myself and Josh and Tulik came, and a couple of the camera crew, and we went, very silently tracking, and I found a Yeti print right by the river, in sort of shale, and it was a good print, you know, and I was very, very pleased.
Nice.
And if I wasn't doing the show, I would have quite happily stayed there looking for the Yeti in that particular area, you know. I would have stayed there doing that because, set up trail crumbs and all that lot. But, you know, for the purposes of the show, for the TV, we had to move on and go and do other things. But I was very encouraged by that. And the other thing I was very encouraged by was that in that area, we found quite a few eyewitnesses in that sort of eastern Nepal area, which were relatively new. And they were talking about seeing the same thing, essentially, a large bipedal creature, not the same size as a Bigfoot, a Sasquatch, you know.
Right.
This was about 6 feet, but with either dark or reddish brown hair, walking bipedally. But and when it moved, they talked a lot about its locomotion, how its rapid locomotion, how it moved very, very quickly. And they talked a lot about that. And so I was very interested in that and how that works. So I went to Nepal, feeling quite perturbed, potentially worried about how this would actually work out. And then, after I'd been to Nepal, I was really encouraged by the fact that there was a potentially vibrant population of Yetis in Nepal, and which was really great news. So I was very pleased by that. I was very pleased at finding the print as well.
Yeah, that's great news, because, like I said,
it was good.
There was talk that Yeti was, on the outs there, because...
Yeah, and I was worried, Tim, I was worried about that. I was worried that, I wouldn't find any evidence. But I took a punt on the east side, and it sort of paid off, really. And that's something I'd definitely go back and look for again. I enjoyed doing it.
When did you go on this expedition?
This was, the show was called... The Hunt for the Yeti. It was a four-parter. I was in the first two parts because I came to San Diego during it, because you met Nadia. I came to be with Nadia. I did the first two parts, and then I went to America, and literally, I abseiled down. There's a scene in it where I'm abseiling down a rock face, and I sort of left at that point, and really, I was running down the... I ran to Lukla, which is the most dangerous airport in the world, because I wanted to make sure I got back to Kathmandu to get my flight to San Diego. And I'm with this government minister, and he's got this big woolen jumper, and he's puffing and panting. He's going, we're going too fast. I'm going, oh, don't worry, mate, you'll be good for another 5 or 10 miles, pushing his ass to make sure I got back to get this flight. I really sort of screamed. When you're ascending altitude, you have to sort of climb high and sleep low, so you can only go so far before you have to stop. And rest. You need to get your body to adapt. You can't just rush up. But on the way down, I went shit off a shovel because I needed to get back to Kathmandu, so I pretty much ran a lot of the way back down, or ran half of the way back down from the mountains to make sure I got it. Over half, yeah. And I'm just trying to recall. Yeah, over half the way we were jogging to make sure I got it. I got back.
Jesus.
It's pretty tough. But it was worth it,
So when was this date-wise, though? Like, when was this? I'm trying to, just sort of place this in the timeline of events.
Well, this was April last year.
Okay, all right. Exciting stuff. So I still think the more I sent you an article the other day. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it's like, part of me, just hearing about the annoying sort of like aspects of this portal story and shit, part of me is just like, Adam, I just wish you just stay with the fucking Orang Pendek, dude. I feel like you're the one that's going to get it. I feel like you're, and now I sent you this article, some crew is going, I think, essentially where you, you know, like to go as well in Sumatra.
Well, we're going to a slightly different area.
Okay.
I mean,
you
know,
explain that to me. Tell us, I guess, recount that.
I don't know. I've only very, very briefly skimmed the article, Tim,
okay.
So you probably know more than I. I'm no expert on that article. But there's a number of projects that's been going on in Sumatra. I mean, one that's been very interesting has been, there's a trail camera track project that's been launched by Jeremy Holden, who associates with Debbie Marshall, and he's a really good cryptozoologist, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for a fact, although, you know, he's found, I can't really say what he's found, it's not a Rang Pendak, but he's found some very interesting photographs, I think, of species that are unknown or very little known to science on these trail cams in Sumatra recently. And I mean, what people need to understand, and I was saying this to my students today, is that there are areas of the world which are not well traversed, and we don't know everything about them, you know. So I've been to the Congo, as you know, to the Kula Swamp, and there's an area the size of Switzerland which is hardly touched by people.
Wow.
There are, you know, and I've flown over it, I've walked through the Kula Swamps, and I'm sure, you know, in some occasions where I was walking, nobody else had walked before.
Yeah.
And that's a bloody big area, you know. And there are vibrant ecosystems. I mean, I think the Sumatran rainforest is even more vibrant than the Amazon. There are these places where there are still the potential, in Papua New Guinea and a couple of other places like that, for new animals and new ecosystems. And the idea of the Orang Pendek, really, you know, and I'll say this again, when people talk about, when people use the term Yeti or jungle Yeti, people are immediately cynical because they think that there's a certain mythology surrounding it.
Right.
But if I say all it is really with the Orang Pendek is a bipedal ape which, you know, we don't know enough about, which is very, really on the edge of extinction, and we're really hoping to find a few before that happens. And you know, what people need to remember as well is for most of our biological ancestry, over many thousands, millions of years, we have coexisted with other branches of humanity, such as Neanderthal, the Hobbit in Sumatra. No, I'm not going to give a big list, and a vision, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know, the idea that we are unique as a species right now with no close relatives would be unparalleled in our evolution.
Right.
Unparalleled.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So people need to think about that. And most of the time, all of this stuff is really scientifically plausible, because all you're saying is that in some areas, ancestors of ours have still remained.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is. There's nothing kooky at all about it. It's just a question is, do they still exist or not? And if they do, can we get evidence of them before we wipe them out, either intentionally or unintentionally, you know, through either habitat destruction, chemicals, whatever else, or they just die out because of lack of breeding potential. So are we going to get hold of of any of them before we do? And that's really what I'm interested in trying to do in my cryptozoological research. And you know, the only way you're going to ever do that is by employing scientific methodology. And I'm not, and I'm not going to ever say that I'm going to have all the answers, but I just hope to find some evidence or push the fold farther so that other people can achieve that. There's no ego in it for me. I don't care about that. I'm not after glory. I'm after answers to questions, always. And have been since I was a boy.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Are you ready for the